Last Word on Today FM.
Owen Smalls McDermott, Managing Director of the Communications Clinic, and our own Kate Henshaw are looking at the week trending for us today. And I want to start with the possibility that the energy crisis could bring about a situation whereby schools would return from September onwards to remote learning, like they did during the COVID crisis. This time, the reason being suggested is that if they can't afford to heat the schools, that way to save money might be to do classes online. Owen, I put this to a couple of secondary school teachers that I know at lunchtime when I was chatting to them, and they were horrified at the idea. They said they would have the children bringing in a lump of coal each to fire up the boilers if need be, but there was no way that they're going back to the idea of teaching secondary school children online.
Yeah, I don't believe anybody enjoyed it. The children, the educators, or the parents, particularly those of younger children. It was a very thought-provoking piece by Paul Davis of DCU, where because of the energy crisis, as you said, Matt, he said we really need to be planning and having contingencies around it. But really, the COVID situation, as we'll all unfortunately remember, was really the threat of death. I don't believe that we'll have that now. And that really, ultimately, any of the analysis post-COVID was that closing of schools in particular was a mistake. Because schools do more than pass on information. They develop people, whether they are children or teenagers or you moving into universities. They give people social skills. They help people develop in a logical way, where moving from primary school to secondary school gives you an element of development. You start learning the ability to negotiate, to handle bullies, to push around, all of those things that are more than just imparting information. And that's why they're so crucial and valuable. Similarly, within the university section, universities aren't just about passing on for information, because if they were, people could just watch a whole series of TED Talks and get informed and educated around it. Whereas universities should be a hotbed of ideas where we challenge one another and we extract kind of information from one another. So the idea that we would not be in person is both worrying and I think unnecessary.
Yes, listeners say it's not just about the heating of the schools though, it's about things like the school buses not being available because the contractors are threatening to pull out because the fuel will be too dear, Kate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are valid concerns. I mean, we are in a fuel crisis, but I don't think this is the answer. I did 2 years online in college, year and a half almost. And like Owen was saying, school is so much more than that information. You do learn all of these skills. I know that he talks in this piece about through structured hybrid models. And I do agree that these things could be options. You can have things like online lectures, maybe online classes for secondary school students as well. He does note that primary education must remain fully in person in this piece as well. But even though those concerns about students commuting long hours per day, he says here as well that students absorb this too through time loss, fatigue, and reduced capacity to engage with long commutes. But this is not the way to fix those problems. The problems that we have with commuting and students having the ability to engage fully in lectures because they're tired from long commutes is a problem for government. That's a housing related issue. That's a transport related issue. Putting things online shouldn't be the solution. And it certainly shouldn't be a first port of call whenever a crisis arises, because there's always going to be another crisis.
Well, maybe there's other ways around it. I mean, it could be staggered school opening times as well. If you're worried about traffic congestion on the roads at a time of low petrol and diesel reserves. Another listener makes another one. Why aren't all the school roofs not covered in solar panels?
Well, that's a very valid point. And if we look, for example, at the idea that we are going to be the greening of Ireland and certainly reducing our dependency on fossil fuels, using spaces like schools, for example, to improve their whatever the school's BEO rating or whatever the equivalent would be, is certainly not so.
But they also would become self-sufficient approach. Because there was a case in the Oireachtas Education Committee this week of a school which has been threatened with being shut off from electricity and gas supplies because it hasn't been able to meet the bills. And we know that there's major problems in education, that the schools say they don't get enough money from the Department of Education, despite the fact that the Department of Education is consistently wildly over budget. And if schools are struggling, then maybe the way about it is that the state actually does actually have to pay to cover every roof of every school in Ireland with solar panels, which presumably then would not just be able to heat and light the schools, could probably supply back into the grid.
Yeah, and I suppose within that though, Matt, there is the assumption that the school is modern enough that it would be able to cope with it. I'm sure there's people listening to this who would say that their children are in inadequate schools. For example, there's a Gael school in North Dublin where there is talk of it being getting a new building, where currently there are people in and kids in prefabs where there is no toilet near them and they have to travel out through the rain to get to the toilet. Now, that's not somewhere that you could put, for example, solar panels. So I think there will be, it's a great idea and that's something you could look at. But I think practically speaking, many parents, teachers and pupils would be saying it would be great to actually have a functioning building before we start worrying about solar panels.
Okay, another listener says, this listener, principal at a 1,000 pupil school, gas bill last year, €60,000, electricity, €45,000, buses, €50,000, somewhat subsidised by parents, get €200,000 to run the school from the government. My home electricity rate is better than the schools have. Why can't the state give a huge discounted price?
I mean, I think this is a conversation we're going to have about various aspects of Irish society now since that huge package has been announced for the hauliers and people in, and farmers and people in the transport sector that are struggling with these fuel costs. But everyone is struggling with these fuel costs. It's not just a matter for these industries. It's everyone. And it is due to this war that is completely out of the Irish government's control because of the total unpredictability of the White House and of the White House's actions in Iran. So I think when we start having these conversations, and there's a good reason we're having these now in the wake of the fuel protests, this is a problem for everyone and is going to continue to be a problem for everyone.
The listener says, you're talking as if the schools are always heated in the winter. That is not the case. I'm aware of that. Another listener says, the government has a scheme underway to put solar panels on all schools. A significant number have already taken place. Okay. Of course, it's not just the schools. I think the trade union movement, isn't it, Kate, is trying to suggest, particularly in the public service, that more people should be allowed to work from home.
Absolutely, Ed. So they're suggesting that people that can work from home should be allowed to have at least one more day working from home to save on fuel costs and consider. And they want the department to consider this less on-site or in-office attendance where possible. Now, obviously, they've done this survey now of 20,000 members and they found 65% currently travel to work 3 or more days a week, with over a quarter working on site full time. A third of the respondents say that they commute more than an hour per day, and half say that the commute time has increased in the past year. Obviously, we've seen a lot of problems with congestion in the past year. So Force's position on this is that one more day of remote work rather would reduce peak hour fuel demand, congestion, fuel consumption. So they're calling for this to try and alleviate some pressure, but obviously this is just not feasible for every single worker. And because of the way companies operate, they have various policies and different policies per company of what is the mandatory office time. It does get a little bit more complicated when you delve into the weeds of a lot of people just simply can't work from home at all.
Absolutely. And then you have things like one of the banks, Bank of Ireland, this week, I think, Owen, was suggesting that people wouldn't qualify for their bonuses if they weren't doing a certain number of days in the office.
Yeah, it's part of their assessment process, and that they have set days for people to be there. And if you're not there, you're not meeting the expectations. Google did a version of this a couple of years ago, Matt, as well, where they were linking people's attendance with their potential bonuses. And that also they started to investigate whether or not they would have paid cuts for those people who are working at home. There is a trend where I would see it, certainly in corporate Ireland, the public sector might be different, where there is now a sense that hybrid is dying, that there are a requirement for more and more people to come to the office. If you look, for example, at the large professional services firms, the likes of the law firms and the accountancy firms, they are insisting that their staff get back into the office, because what they're beginning to see is that the human skills required to build the relationships, to get on with clients, to win work, the ability to collaborate properly, the ability to brainstorm and figure out ideas is best done in person. So although I don't think hybrid is dead, I would say in the next decade we will start seeing it fizzle out. Also, when the jobs market contracts, and we're probably likely to get a tightening and a contraction of the jobs market, where it shifts from being a seller's market to a buyer's market, and when employers are starting to look at and employees are starting to find that there are fewer jobs, I suspect what we'll start seeing is people saying, right, you're now getting back into the office, because that in-person face-to-face is starting to really be seen as a necessity in the private sector, and the cynic in me is would suggest that Force as a trade union are always looking for an opportunity to give people an opportunity to work from home.
And one listener says, bring in the 4-day work week to help reduce the commuting cost. That's a very 1970s idea, which I think was brought in for some workplaces at the time of the oil crisis back then. Kate, tell us all about this serious stabbing at Connolly Station in Dublin earlier in the week.
The stabbing that never was. This is
not according to influencers on social media who are American.
Yes, the usual suspects. So there were false claims of this stabbing at Connolly Station, which were mainly spread by US commentators that had actually come over here to cover the fuel protests. So there's this one guy called Kevin Pozobiak, where he came over to cover what he called a tractor parade when the fuel protests were happening. And he started spreading this rumour of this alleged stabbing that happened in Connolly Station. Now, the Department of Transport did confirm that there was no stabbing. It was somebody that had had a procedure done on their ankle and was going up the escalator and their stitches ripped. But a video then circulated on social media of this trail of blood that was indeed in the station. With these allegations that there was this stabbing in Connolly Station, which was then spread by these kind of influencers. Now, Kevin has posted about this on X, which got over 2.2 million views. He actually went to Connolly Station as well to, quote-unquote, investigate the alleged incident that didn't happen. And he was, security was then called on him, and he filmed himself while the staff were telling him that the story was false, that there was no stabbing, and he kept repeating over and over again, he saw on the news that somebody got stabbed here, and then posted this online to his many, many followers, which then started a whole train of misinformation.
Of course, it would never have happened in America. Owen, Tomás, what do you make of this?
Yeah, and interestingly, Kevin Pozobiak, or however we pronounce their surname, is a brother of Jack, who came up with the, or was one of the key people who drove the Pizzagate theory. And that
from about a decade back.
Yeah, which, as you can see, it was sticky and created a significant amount of conversation. And for anybody who's forgotten, Pizzagate was the idea that there was a child exploitation ring ran predominantly by Democrats in the basement of a pizza restaurant in New York, which again shows, I suppose, within the family there is a trend towards the conspiracy theories. It's also in part shows, like, I'm not sure much of this is even driven by ideology. It just seems to be that they want clicks, 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 and engagement, engagement, engagement. It also shows that Ireland is becoming both the subject and at times the source of content for the US culture wars, and that we are feeding this unending appetite for the American culture wars, whether that is Joe Rogan, for example, talking about Enoch Burke being jailed for his, quote, religious beliefs, or Conor McGregor, who seems now to have developed a career where he's constantly feeding American culture wars with his criticism of Ireland. And this notion, again, within the US, that Europe and Ireland and places like it are in decay, whether moral or otherwise, which, as we would all know, who as people who live there, is very far from the truth. And also what we see is particularly a race element to it, where this person would have gone in through, whatever his name is, Pasaybek, would have gone into a park and observed two non-white people and talked about how they were selling crack.
Because they're not white, so therefore they must be selling crack.
Yeah, whereas actually anybody who has any wit knows that the drugs market in Ireland is driven by white men selling drugs to white people. Like, that is it in a nutshell. So there is this trend within it where we're starting, if not have already observed, Ireland being both the subject and now at times the source of this content.
Okay, well, his listener says, who pays him to come to Ireland to cover the fuel protests? Let me guess, he's anti-immigration, anti-vaccine, great replacement theory proponent, in which case there's plenty of money being spread about. Yes, indeed. There'll be lots of Americans coming to Ireland next year to spend lots of money supporting their team against Europe, Kate, at the Ryder Cup in Adair Manor in Limerick. Now, a big chunk of the tickets, there'll be 55,000 people a day, I think, left onto the course in County Limerick over the 3 days that the event takes place, and of course also other numbers in the practice rounds beforehand. There was consternation this week when it was revealed that the cost of a day pass to the Irish ticket holders would be €499. Opposition TDs were up in arms about it. So when The website was opened, the ticketing was opened this morning. Did the Irish people shun these €499 tickets?
No, they certainly did not. There were up to 60,000 people in the queue. That was just what people were reporting online for these tickets. And you remember, this is the Irish only window. So it's people who are resident in Ireland. There will be a more kind of general sale on the 3rd of June. So there were 60,000 people in the queue. There was various complaints that the website was crashing, that they weren't moving up in the queue, and there was technical difficulties. Now, I will say that the Ryder Cup did then come out and say that there were no widespread issues with purchasing the tickets. They said that tickets have been selling out at anticipated levels, given Irish fans' renowned enthusiasm for golf and for the Ryder Cup. But like you say, the cost of these tickets is just extortionate. It's €499 per day. It's €1,999 for the week.
And that's before all your other costs are added in as well.
Accommodation and the likes, which God knows how much that'll set people back.
Parking and then getting from wherever you park to the course.
It is absolutely extortionate. They have kind of advertised that they had cheaper tickets, but these are for the practice days on Tuesday and Wednesday. So you wouldn't be seeing any of the real Ryder Cup action. They are priced at €89 each with €20 tickets available for under 16s. Just out of interest, earlier today, I looked up the 2006 prices for the Ryder Cup, which is the last time it happened here at the K Club. Now, it's 20 years ago. And the four-day ticket at that stage would set you back €345. So that's over €100 cheaper than one day now. And we must also remember the last time that it was held in Europe, which was in Rome in 2023, there were admission tickets available for €260. So there's been this huge jump.
I tell you how much of a Celtic Tiger environment it was then. We actually had a specially built studio overlooking the 18th tee, and that's where I broadcast the programme from on the Friday of the Ryder Cup. And we spent the day wandering around the course, interviewing people into the clubhouse, all the rest of it.
Those were the good old days.
Oh my God, I have heart eyes going on. That would be my dream. The Ryder Cup officer, Richard Atkinson, has kind of been excusing the price of saying it's lower than Bethpage as well, which I thought was hilarious, because there's no fair comparison between American prices and Irish prices.
Well, indeed, Owen, there is a number of issues here. One listener wants to know how long before a lot of these tickets get resold, whether these people who got on today are going to turn a quick profit on flogging them on, which then also says, well, there will be people out there who will be willing to pay more than €500 a day. I suspect it might be an awful lot of businesses will buy them and will bring clients and things like that as their guests. But if the price had been forced downwards by some sort of government intervention, it still was the same number of tickets available, which just meant maybe just a few different people would have got the tickets.
Yeah, and there's part of the challenge is that there's always going to be limited amount of tickets available for anything to go. And I think, as Kate mentioned, the last time it was in Ireland was 20 years ago and will be 21 years ago. So even that notion that it is a rare event that everybody would want to go to, and then that people like to spend a few bob more on rare events. Like if we compare it to an All-Ireland final ticket, for example, which is €100, what happens every year in the same place, and it's an amazing experience. But a football match and a hurling match is 70 minutes plus half time, so you're playing with almost 2 hours. You'll get four or five times that length of time on a golf course, albeit you mightn't see as much excitement, as much entertainment. But when you compare it minute for minute, actually the tickets aren't hugely different in terms of the price. Also, what makes the Ryder Cup unique is it's a little different to other golf tournaments, where it's actually great crack and really important and really great entertainment and atmosphere from T1, round one, which is unusual. Even when you think back to Rory's win in the Masters, it kind of gets exciting for the last four or five holes, so there is that. Also though, the notion that anybody was surprised at the price of things, it's in Adair Manor, for example. I checked how much it would cost to stay for two nights in Adair Manor on the bank holiday weekend. €3,200, and I'm not even sure they're thrown in brekkie. For a plate of sushi, I had a look there, it costs €80 and you get eight pieces. That's €10 for a piece of sushi. So look, the fact that the tickets are so expensive isn't necessarily that big a surprise, nor if you go minute by minute against one of our most loved days, the hurling All-Ireland final or the football All-Ireland final, it's actually not that bad value.
Okay, got my hands on a practice day ticket. Delighted. If I had the €499, I would have paid it, a once in a lifetime experience. This is a capitalist environment we live in and it's sold out. Why is anyone surprised? Another one says, we, the residents of Adair village. All the households in the village received a letter this morning giving us the chance to book two tickets for the Ryder Cup free of charge, which we did earlier this afternoon. So fair play to the Ryder Cup committee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I had the €499, I would have spent it as well. I would like to put that on the record. I'd love to go. It just seems very expensive.
Okay, and the other thing I want to ask you about, what's happening, Kate, in Britain, this idea that people born after 2008, which means they'd be 18 if they were born in 2008 now, will no longer be allowed to buy tobacco?
So there was a really long run of this legislation through the UK Parliament. It started when it was introduced on the 5th of November 2024. So this is basically will ban anyone born after 2008 from ever legally buying cigarettes. They're trying to create this smoke-free generation, which we've already seen been done in other places. Excuse me. They're basically citing the cost that smoking puts, particularly on the NHS, for the reason for this legislation. It causes 64,000 deaths in England alone per year. And the total cost to society are around $21.3 billion and $27.6 billion a year in England alone. So there's a cost element to this, but there's also a health element to this. And I think the theory is that if people never pick up smoking, then they'll never have any desire to. But they haven't really considered that there's generations above that that already smoke, and that potentially some of these people under the age of 18, like you say, people born in 2008 would be 18 now, they may already smoke. They do also talk about vapes in this as well. They're trying to ban vapes and nicotine products from being branded, promoted and advertised to children. That's something we've seen here. But there is a bit of a sense around this that it might be too little too late on the vapes front, at least. And there is also concerns already being raised that a ban, a complete and total ban on smoking, would just push cigarettes into the black market eventually, and that people will find ways similar to illegal drugs to get their hands on cigarettes should they desire to.
What do you make of this, Sean?
Yeah, and I think on the vape piece, for example, there's no, unfortunately, longitudinal research yet into it in terms of the impact of it. So we really don't know how dangerous or not they are. I think it was the Maldives who first of all brought in this generational ban on tobacco, and then New Zealand followed. And it strikes me, though, that at times public policy comes in when the fight is actually over, by and large. Like the vast majority of people understand that smoking is a terrible thing for us to do. And that if we think back to Ireland and the smoking ban in 2004, that was probably a point where a generational ban could have come in because people would have been accepting of it. Yet 22 years later, we're still weighing it up. Interestingly, I viewed it interesting. I was away in Sofia in Bulgaria for work a couple of weeks ago. And what struck me was it was like being in Ireland in the 1990s. The amount of people that were still smoking was staggering. The amount of advertisement for smoking was staggering. And I was then reading post-fact was that Bulgaria now has the highest number of cardiovascular disease in Europe, in part due to the volumes of smoking. And as Kate said, the more we can reduce smoking, the better. Like, we don't need to remind people that one in two people die of smoking-related deaths if you're smoking. So that's a challenge. So I think overall it's a good idea.
Owen Tomás McDermott from the Communications Clinic, Kate Henshaw from The Last Word team, thank you both very much for being with us.
The Last Word on Today FM.